It's the 365 Days of Astronomy podcast, coming in 3, 2, 1.
Listening to the NASA Lunar Science Institute podcast, which highlights the latest news and information of the moon, on the moon, and from the moon. It's produced by the NASA Lunar Science Institute at the Ames Research Center in Moffett Field, California.
Hi, this is Nancy Atkinson for the NASA Lunar Science Institute. We know that the moon has been victim of countless impacts during its history, where the surface has been pummeled and sometimes turned to liquid from the heat of the impacts. This hot liquid lava would mix with minerals from the impactor, changing the surface makeup of the moon. But new research has shown that lunar impacts may not have completely wiped away the pre-existing mineralogy on the moon. Joining me today is Deepak Dhingra, a graduate student in planetary geosciences at Brown University, who is the lead author of a recent paper published in the journal Geophysical Research Letters. Hi, Deepak, and thanks for being with us.
Hi, Nancy.
Now, this is a fairly surprising finding. How did you start down the path of researching this topic?
So I have been sort of looking at impact melts for a while. In lunar literature, if you look around, they have been most of the time studied in terms of their morphology. And with the most recent set of spacecraft that have gone to the moon and returned wealth of information, we can now look at the mineralogy of impact melt in far more detail than was possible earlier on. In the process of looking at the mineralogical makeup of these melts, I was looking across melts at different craters of different sizes. When you look at the mineralogy, you basically look at different spectral parameters. We have a set of predefined criteria when we look for mineralogical differences. And at Copernicus, which is the focus of my research for this paper, it's a 96 kilometer diameter crater on the Earth's facing side of the moon. And when we looked at the composition of melts there, we clearly saw at least two different kinds of melt. One that was having a more magnesium-rich pyroxene composition and which was sinuous in its character. The other one, which is the more prevalent composition, is spread all across the floor and surrounds the sinuous feature. This melt is rich in what we call as iron and calcium rich pyroxenes. And these two different kind of impact melts surprisingly have linked to the pre-existing target which was melted. From other studies, we know that the pre-existing target comprised of basalts. These are dark colored rocks and the dark patches you see on the lunar near side. And norites, which are rock types which comprise of the highlands. They don't form entirely the highlands, but they are a component of it. And we see the exact two compositions in the impact melt. That made us sort of infer that the composition we are seeing in impact melt is actually the composition of the original target, because we have direct link with it.
Okay. Now, you use data from the Chandrayaan spacecraft's moon mineralogy mapper. Could you talk about the data that you used?
So we used actually a wide variety of data, primarily moon mineralogy mapper, but supplemented by many other data sets, starting with MCUBE, which was a NASA guest instrument on board Chandrayaan 1. It is an imaging spectrometer. So what we have is an array of detectors which capture the data in image format. They collect data in a way where light is split into several wavelengths, both in the visible and near infrared. it is the variability in the detected light intensity across these wavelengths that helps us identify different minerals on Moon's surface. Now, apart from M-Cube, we also used data from the Japanese Kaguya mission, and the data was terrain camera, so it's an imaging camera which provides a spatial resolution of the order of 5 meters per pixel. We also used data from the currently in orbit Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter mission, and there we used the data from the laser altimeter. So merging all these data sets together, we not only define the mineralogical differences, but we go and look at those places at very high resolution with Kaguya terrain camera and characterize the surface topography, how smooth or rough it is.
The press release from Brown University kind of qualified this as it would be like dumping a 4-course meal into a blender and then trying to pick out the potatoes in, you know, identifying the pre-impact mineral variation that's there. Does this mean that perhaps we don't understand how the creating ring process on the Moon works as well as we thought?
At least this result does show that earlier understanding of the impact cratering was that when you are melting the material, all of it actually gets mixed up very well, and what you end up is sort of a bland looking, very homogeneous sheet of impact melt. What this result shows is not only that part is not true across all craters, it also tells us that it can happen at such a large scale where you can have a patch of 30 kilometer long material, which is very different from the surrounding material, and both got melted. So it tells us that at such large scales, or at least at the scale of Copernicus, 100 kilometers diameter, it is possible that material, after it got melted, it still stayed separate and didn't actually mix very well.
Okay. The Copernicus crater has been one of the best studied craters on the Moon. How surprising is this for you and your colleagues to have found this?
Yeah, it has been not only studied by telescopes, it has been studied by spacecraft data, and from diversity of instruments, it is indeed a very surprising result. Especially because if you look at the image of Copernicus, just a black and white image, it's very hard to see any difference. And that is where the utility of looking at the light that we cannot see with our own eyes, the utility of that comes in. That when you look at mineralogical differences, a very smooth looking area suddenly looks very different. And that is indeed surprising.
Will you be looking at other craters in a similar way to do further research for this?
Yeah, so right now what we are doing is we are looking at many different aspects of this problem. So we are looking at other craters on the Moon which may show similar differences. We are also looking in detail to be able to characterize how different these two compositions are. Using theoretical modeling, you can try to generate the spectra and try to match the compositional differences that you are observing there. So that's one aspect that we have added to this existing result. And the other aspect is to really evaluate whether we can differentiate a case where the original composition is preserved versus a case where everything got mixed up, everything got melted, and it actually got recrystallized. So that's how rocks form. So when you melt material, it cools off and different compositions get together to form different minerals. So that's the other possibility that is still to be evaluated. So we are keeping our eyes open and looking for evidences where we can differentiate between these two possibilities.
Is there a way to tell or estimate how much of the Moon is not native that was brought there by impacts?
That's a little hard question, as because of many reasons. One, the fact that when impacts occur, especially on the moon, they come at such a high velocity, something of the order of 15 kilometers per second, that a lot of it gets vaporized. The second part is that in cases when fragments of these impactors do survive, they are just too small for us to detect them from remote sensing. However, I can point you to one of the recent papers where people have looked at magnetic anomalies on the moon and cited them as evidence for material that was non-native to the moon. But that is just one of the very few results we have. Apart from that, people have looked at lunar samples and meteorites. In those cases, at microscopic scale, yes, you can look at the fragments or the material that was brought from outside. So we actually need to look at various levels. And in that case, you can have some idea about how much material that was brought from outside.
For your research, you worked with Dr. Carly Peters, who's one of NLSI's principal investigators. As a grad student, how advantageous is it to be able to work with someone with her experience?
The reason for joining her for my PhD or for my research was because she is one of the most experienced spectroscopists in the world. And with that diversity of experience that she has, not only from telescopic data, but to spacecraft data, and from Apollo era till present, it means a lot to understand the finer details of spectral differences, to infer the science out of it, and more importantly, the limits up to which you should push and you should infer data. Over-interpreting of data is one thing that is quite common in remote sensing, and with an experience that she has, I have been able to think much more practically.
Well, your paper is very interesting. Is there anything else that you feel it's important for people to know about this research?
Apart from the technicalities that I mentioned, one thing that each one of us needs to remember is that craters, or the impact cratering process, has happened across all planetary bodies. So it's a solar system-wide process. It happened on the moon, Mercury, Mars, and all other planets, but it also happened on Earth. So anything that we are trying to infer, we are understanding, contributes to our own existence on the Earth. And that is the prime motivation for any science that we do, and this science, impact cratering in particular.
Okay, well, Deepak, thank you very much for joining us today and giving us more information about your research. And we'll post links to more information on our podcast page. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nancy.
To find out more about this topic, visit our website at www.lunarscience.nasa.gov. Any opinions expressed are those of the individual and do not necessarily reflect the opinion of NASA or the NASA Lunar Science Institute. This podcast is produced for educational and information purposes only. On behalf of the NASA Lunar Science Institute, thanks for listening.
You are listening to the IYA 365 Days of Astronomy podcast. Cool.
The 365 Days of Astronomy podcast is produced by Astrosphere New Media Association. Audio post-production by Scott Lewis. Bandwidth donated by Libsyn.com and Wizard Media. Web design by Clockwork Active Media Systems. You may reproduce and distribute this material for non-commercial purposes. Please consider supporting the podcast with a few dollars or euros. Visit us on the web at cosmoquest.org/blog/365daysofastronomy or email us at info@365daysofastronomy.org. Until tomorrow, goodbye.